Call the meeting to order. Representative Sertich, do you want to approve the minutes?
I move approval of the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilken, do you want to move your bill?
Yep, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that House File 1669 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. And I would also like to... what's that? Civil law? Civil law.
Civil law. I knew that's what you meant.
That's what I meant. You just heard me wrong, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Point of parliamentary inquiry.
Representative Sertich.
I believe there's a motion before the committee to approve the minutes.
Oh, thank you. Oh, excuse me. there is a motion before us to approve the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
No?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that House File 1669 be recommended pass and re-referred to civil law.
Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, just to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to talk about it, I'd move the A1 amendment. You just have a quick vote on that.
Representative Rukavina?
Yes. Chair, did this meet the 24-hour rule?
Yes, it did, Mr. Representative Rukavina.
Yes, Representative Rukavina, and thank you for asking. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. To your bill.
Okay, members, this is the Insurance Regulatory Modernization Act. It's been introduced on a bipartisan basis in the House. Representative Atkins and Representative Tenza are co-authors of mine. In the Senate, Representative Metzen and our Senators Metzen and Sparks are also on the bill. This bill is supported by both agents and insurance companies, which if you've been around the insurance world very long, they don't always necessarily agree on these things. So it's kind of nice to have a consensus bill here. This is also, I would view it as a jobs bill. Minnesota has been hurting on the insurance jobs front. We're uncompetitive in many ways regulatorily, and we're losing jobs out of state. Other states are poaching on our jobs, and there's always the threat that some of our large insurers could move jobs out of state. One that comes to mind is always St. Paul Travelers. They have many, many options. One of the issues that comes up is when Minnesota-domiciled insurance companies are trying to approve, have forms and rates approved in other states, often many states require them to be approved in Minnesota first, and that process has been quite slow. And also, current law doesn't reflect our new kind of electronic way of doing business. So just to walk you through the bill, Section 1 drops the requirement that policies be reprinted every 5 years. And it requires an internet-based access to the policy language. But the amendment we adopted also requires that policyholders be notified annually that if they request a copy of the policy, a fresh copy, that they can get that. There's no reason to reprint it. I've got a file at home. I just throw my policy in and all the renewals, and frankly, there's probably over the years, several copies of the same policy have been built up, and it's a waste of paper, a waste of postage, and all those things. And as long as they're very accessible to the insured, I think that's an important part. Section 2 simply addresses the filing fee for that conforms to the changes later in the bill. Sections 3, 8, 9, 10, and 11 go to change the way we file forms in the state of Minnesota to join what 30 other states are doing and go to a file in use rather than a prior approval. With prior approval, you submit forms and rates to the department. They go through them after what seems like a very lengthy process. Then they get approved. But what this does, it just doesn't let you off the hook. Just say, mail it in and go to town. Under this bill, the insurer must sign and certify by an officer of the corporation that the forms and the rates comply with Minnesota rules and law. Section 4 addresses independent agent rehabilitation, and the fact that we have both agents and companies' representatives supporting this says a lot. Currently, for independent agents, there's a process that if a contract's going to be terminated, that they go through some kind of rehabilitation process to see if they can't salvage the business relationship. What this is going to say is that they can discontinue that relationship, but they get, I believe it's an extra 18 months to continue to write policies, so that that allows the agent to expedite finding another carrier to cover those insurers. And it also prevents the companies from lowering or reducing the commissions paid to those agents during that time. That was Section 4 and 5. Section 6 is a technical provision. There's at the federal level, there's a Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, and that's coming up on expiration. What this does is says that since that's a change in coverage, if that act expires, that that's exempted from the requirements for disclosure 60 days prior to renewal. That's just because we don't know if it'll be renewed or allowed to expire. Section 7 is regarding insurance binders and allows those to be forwarded to the insured electronically, which is the way business is going. And I think the last section to address is Section 12, which just simply addresses more of way of updating doing business as far as collecting personal information that is used in underwriting, that the authorization is for as long as that insured maintains that relationship with the insurance company. So there's still that obligation for confidentiality in there. And that is it. I'll let my testifiers add their comments.
State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dominic Spizzetto, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents Association. We are obviously in support of this legislation. We think it is a good idea to try and reduce unnecessary expense involved in the insurance transaction, and then also make it more efficient and, to a certain extent, modernize and play a little catch-up with our state law in terms of what's going on in the private marketplace today. I'm going to speak to four sections of the bill which relate to insurance agents, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Johnson, who will talk about the other sections of the bill. We are very interested in Section 1, which eliminates the requirement that you get this huge policy every 5 years. Normally what you get after a renewal is what we call a deck sheet or a declaration sheet, which will give you all the information that you actually need. It'll give you the premium rate. It'll give you the coverages that you're purchasing. And generally that's what most agents and policyholders look at upon a policy renewal. The policy itself, which can be a very heavy document, is frankly not looked upon by agents or policyholders to that extent, something that's kept in a drawer somewhere. So this would eliminate the requirement that we provide that to you. However, with the amended language, this would be available upon a policyholder's request if they are crazy or sick enough to request one. So, and they may do that. The other sections that I'd like to talk about, I'm sure that
yes,
perhaps
you
can.
Okay.
The other section I want to talk about, Section 4 and 5, which Representative Wilkin indicated, relates to the termination of insurance agent contracts. This relates to independent insurance agents, those agents that write for several companies. And it's not uncommon at times for some of the companies to decide that they no longer want to have that agent as part of their field force for a variety of reasons. They may not have enough volume. They may not like the business. There may just be a parting of the ways. But there's a process in statute that protects the companies and the agents and the policyholders if that agent has been with the company for more than 3 years. And what it does is it basically allows that agent to continue to write existing business for a certain period of time. And that gives the agent and the policyholder an opportunity to shop around. Without that, you could lose your coverage just because your agent was terminated, and it had no correlation to your experience with the company or whatever. So this would, in essence, give the policyholder and the agent 18 months to continue with that existing coverage, and it gives us more time to find another carrier if we choose so. Of course, the policyholder always has the opportunity to stay with that existing company and choose another agent if they choose to do so. We are getting rid of a mandatory requirement in the agent termination law, which was called rehabilitation. It was an attempt to develop a one-year plan to rehabilitate the company and the agent so that they could get back into a mutually agreed-to plan and then avoid termination. Frankly, that hasn't worked in the marketplace. Most times when a company has made the decision to terminate an agency contract, they've made it on a variety of reasons that probably aren't going to be something that will be rehabilitated. So in general, we're willing to give that up, and in doing so, the companies have agreed to give us more time to find business and keep that existing coverage with that carrier until we do so. The last section I want to call to your attention is Section 7, which, as Representative Wilkin indicated, relates to the binder law. Current law requires that we provide written binders through the mail. That process is pretty much obsolete, although there are carriers that continue to do so. This would allow us to provide binders through fax or, more importantly, electronically. And this becomes a major issue as it relates to mortgages. When you go into a mortgage closing and you need proof of insurance in order to close that, and you have this sort of binder requirement, and you really don't want to wait for the mail to be able to do this electronically and to do it through fax, which frankly is what many people are doing now, would be very, very helpful. So with those sections, I'll turn it over to Mr. Johnson and indicate again our support for this legislation. Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, Trade Association of all the Minnesota-based companies, insurance companies, and then quite a few others doing business. The chief author has explained well the sections that I have here, but let me just briefly highlight and maybe underscore why this is important. And as I have chatted with the leadership on both the House and the Senate and the committee and at the legislature and the authors, the co-authors, is that the financial services and insurance marketplace is changing a lot. I'm a native Minnesotan. I've been doing this for a lot of years, and how our association looks today from when I started in 1977 is really different. And it's important to underscore that right now, and this isn't good or bad, it's what it is. And what we need to do is get smarter, frankly, on the marketplace, how it's operating, how we're positioning ourselves, not compromise core consumer protections, which this does not do, and I've been a part of many, many, many law passages up here. We have a number of unique provisions in our insurance laws. We've supported most of them when they've been passed or worked out with whoever was advancing them at the time. And so from our perspective, here are some reasons to that we should be concerned. Our five largest companies in Minnesota in the last 5 years have had a full 10% cutback in employment. Today, over the last 3 years, we've lost just under 10% of our Minnesota-based companies. They're no longer Minnesota-based companies. And we're not suggesting this is the solution to all that. What we're saying is that there are things in our laws, there are marketplace realities that we need to do better at. We think we can do it. It's not compromising core statutes. It's not compromising provisions in law that is, we can get into all of these, go through the details about to demonstrate that that's the case. The filings issue is one. I can tell the committee this, that in looking at a resource book put out by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and this underscores kind of the resource issue. We're not the only state where there are budgetary issues in funding state regulation. Our Minnesota Department, Commerce Department, and the insurance part of it in particular, has had the highest percentage reduction of full-time equivalent employees of all 50 state insurance departments in the last 5 years. Number one reduction. That's a full 30% reduction in FTE positions. Now, I'm bringing this here. They didn't ask me to. I didn't check it with them. I'm just here to report to you. One of the factors that's affecting the marketplace is the ability to process the paper. They get 6,000 filings a year that go into that department with products. It's about a 50-50 split. They've got a lot of experienced people, but the ability to move all that is increasingly challenged, and it's not working the way it used to work. It's not a fault issue, it's a factual issue. So from our perspective, the sections of the bill 3, 9, and 10, Chairman Wilkin indicated, the expedited filing on personal auto and homeowners clearly represents where the marketplace is going. The protections are in place, the signed certification, the commerce will develop a form, an officer has to sign it. All the statutes, they have to comply with. We're not changing any of the statutory provisions, but it is going to expedite the ability, and it is one of the key factors. Like it or not, and sometimes I don't like it, but the point of the matter is there is an intense competition around amongst the states for these jobs. They're high-paying, very high-paying jobs, and states want them. And I didn't bring here, I could bring you the letters from Governor Vilsack and Governor Doyle and the governor of Nebraska and their economic development, and I could show you what's been happening, but just assure you that I can do all that, can demonstrate it to you. And we think these are, A, in the filing areas, they're reasonable. They're going to help Minnesota companies. I'll give you another dimension to it. The reality is that if we have a slowdown in the processing of Minnesota filings, for instance, there's 5 states in this country that will not consider the filings of Minnesota-based insurers unless the Minnesota Department has acted on their filings. They're literally blocked out at the gate of those states. If we're a slow-processing state, our Minnesota companies are penalized because they're here, and it doesn't get processed as fast. So we're not looking to sidestep the statutory provisions. We think this is a reasonable and it recognizes the marketplace, and in these product areas, it's fine. It's tuned to the differences. In other words, the sections of the bill that deal with the life and annuity and long-term care products, they actually take the proposition, let's bring added resources to the department. In other words, to help the department expedite an annuity filing, the language that's in this bill says that the department can pick a qualified outside actuary, and there's firms in town here that do this, and then the company making the filing will pay the cost of that outside actuary. They'll bring the resources to the table, and it's all under the department control, and then that'll facilitate the quicker processing of that filing. We think that's reasonable. California's done that. Massachusetts has done that. So part of what you're seeing here is other states' attempts to deal with the resource issues, which are increasingly critical and need attention. I think the section dealing with Section 6, dealing with the renewal of commercial policies in the 60 days advance notice, We simply need to do this because we're not certain whether TRIA, the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, is going to be reauthorized. And because of that uncertainty, we simply can't comply with that state law and give advance notice of terms, and it's terms imposed by the federal government. The real purpose of this law is when individual companies are changing their rates to give their customers notice of the company rate changes, and the federal TRIA law is, it's not a company decision, it's a federal program. And they have dropped the program on the nation, and so we think it's a reasonable exclusion from that law. It keeps the court law, and it keeps the notice of changes in rates. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, just commenting on Section 12 of the bill, and here's one of those areas, and it can get a little complicated, but actually not really. We have a state privacy law that governs all the information that insurance companies collect in Minnesota. We're the first state in America to pass a state-specific privacy law. It actually preceded all the model acts that it evolved after we did it way back in 1981. And so we haven't had a lot of updating of the law since. Since then, we've had Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and we have had the 50 state regulators adopt some model uniform laws. And what's in this bill, on page 9 of the bill, in particular the sections that we keep the requirement for this written authorization to collect personal information, and I think I'm accurate in saying I think we're the only state of the 50 that require a written authorization up front. The real protection or the real reason for our Data Practices Act is to protect the personal information once it goes into the insurance company and to make certain it goes nowhere else unless the consumer gives authorization for it to go. That state, in other words, that's the core reason for that statute. We're not changing that. We're literally saying, let's be more pragmatic on the upfront. When you choose to do business with somebody and you continue to do business and pay premiums, that the authorization ought to be able to extend for the duration of your doing business. And when you leave them, then you'll sign an authorization with a new company. And those are the core changes there. The very last page of the bill is conforming. The last page of the bill is actually a duplication in part of the language on the bottom of page 9 of the bill that deals with accessing of insurance or credit score information. And the legislature a few years back passed paragraph C on the bottom of page 9. And I just referenced that to you just so you know that the policy contained on the last page of the bill is actually duplicates the paragraph C at the bottom there, which deals with agents accessing the information. And we think that we ought to have that same standard for insurers, because it's the insurers that are underwriting the coverage. So that, Mr. Chairman, is the comments I have on the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Johnson, I have one quick question, and we've got others already, but how many states use file in use now or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, I was going through a chart, and it's actually two states just switched to file and use. It's either 30 or 31 states use a form of file and use or use and file. You'll see some different descriptions of it, but it's in the trend is growing up. There are a number of states that don't have it where it's in play and being debated even this year.
Because I see it, you know, the process is too long now, and if a company's filing a rate to be more competitive, that's going to be passed on to the consumer. So versus now they have to wait, and it takes a little bit longer. But Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 9, section 12, where you get ongoing ability to collect information on a person that has policy with you, as long as the individual has policy with you, that really steps outside of the normal process for data privacy, because almost any time an individual authorizes somebody to collect information on them, it's for 1 year. So you would be putting the insurance companies over and above anybody else that collects private data on individuals and saying you can do that as long as the person has insurance with you. That's highly unusual. The other thing is on page 7, this area where we talk about, it's E under on page 7, where we talk about that the actuary has to be a member of the American Academy of Actuaries with at least 5 years relevant experience in annuity pricing. Most all of those people in that range work for the insurance industry. And my question is for the department, does the department have actuaries right now that fit into this qualification? And if they don't, then it would be, and they have very little chance of hiring one unless they hire it away from an insurance company. But of course, the state can't pay as much as the insurance industry does. So I think there might be some conflict of interest here with forcing the department to hire actuaries. Actuaries are very difficult to find, and especially under these qualifications that you're asking for. So is the department in the audience? Can they answer this question?
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to the first comment?
We'll let Mr. Johnson answer first, and then if the Commerce wants to address that, we will.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Goodwin, maybe we can just go back to the first comment on page 9. And actually, this is not out of the norm. What's out of the norm today in Minnesota law is having, in the insurance data practices law, which all 50 states have, what's out of the norm is having a written authorization requirement at the front box. State laws do not do that. So this is not out of the norm. What's out of the norm is even having a written authorization requirement. And if we distributed to the committee the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Fair Insurance Information Practices Act, which the regulators have developed, they don't have a written authorization requirement in it. We're keeping the written authorization requirement because, as I indicated, this is a unique state law. Ours is unique, and we think this is a workable amendment to that law. So you're not correct that this is a uniqueness. In the world of insurance data practices, which is regulated by all 50 states with comprehensive state laws that protect personal data when it goes into each company, we're not touching any of that. That data cannot move out without the written authorization of the individual, unless it goes to a prosecutor or there's specific law enforcement exceptions to the prohibition on personal data going anywhere. So the core consumer protections are intact. I think on the actuary issue, I'm confident we could get a listing for you of the independent actuaries in the metropolitan area that work at firms like Tillinghast, independent actuarial firms that are not owned by or run by, and they're not insurance company actuaries. And in fact, it won't be an insurance company actuary that's brought in here. It will be an independent firm. Commerce currently contracts with independent actuarial firms to do work and review. And so this is not out of the norm at all, and this is an experience requirement. I'm sure we could get a listing of the professionals in the metropolitan area that would satisfy the statutory standard, and you'd find it's a number of them, and these are not people that work at insurance companies.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, I'd like that list, and I'd also still like my question answered on how many the department actually has in commerce. I know that actuaries, there's probably something like 10,000 actuaries in the United States. There's not a lot, and so I'd be very surprised if here in the metro area we were blessed with a lot more than a normal area would that do not work for insurance companies.
Mr. Chairman, there's three at the department. Pat Sexton held up his hand.
There's three actuaries that
at
have
the
5 years.
Department.
And
yeah, they all have 15 plus years of experience.
Excellent. Okay, that answers that question. Then the data privacy thing I'm concerned about, because I really don't care what the data practices are in the insurance industry in the other 50 states. What the data practices are here in Minnesota is if you are authorized for 1 year unless you get reauthorized, and that's for medical records, that's for almost every area. So I think it is a big change for Minnesota. I really am not concerned what the other states do with data privacy. The other thing is on this whole section where you're changing the expedited filing, this I think we need to look at real closely. I am not comfortable with this without the department coming up and talking about how this changes the current, how the current process is done and how this process would be done. I understand your comment, Representative Gazelka, about if the rates are going to be lowered, then they can do it right away. I would also like to know when the last time rates were lowered, because I don't know that that's happened on any type of insurance for a very long time, if ever. So then the question becomes, are we expediting increasing the rates faster than we really need to? And that shouldn't they be examined closely so we know that our consumers are protected with these rate changes? So that would be...
So, Representative Goodwin, do you want the Commerce Department to speak? Is that
yes,
what you're asking?
I would. I'd like to know the difference between this filing system and the filing system we currently have and how that will affect the consumer.
Okay. Come on. Apparently they'll be right back.
Representative
Wilkin.
Mr. Chairman, I think they're going to get the big guns.
You really
care about the department. So, Representative Goodwin, the department does business as we tell them to. I think this is very... I don't know if your concern is that there's less consumer protection or something in this, but the insurance companies, I can't think of an insurance executive that would sign their name on something when a policy or rate is not complying with state law. What will happen is on a retrospective review done by the department, they'll get whacked over the head pretty good. and that gets really costly to bring the correct policies that are floating out there, the correct rates. They would lose a lot of money if they had to do that. So there's absolutely no incentive for them to go outside the norm of what is allowed in Minnesota law or rule.
Before we have the Commerce Department speak, I can just say that in my night job, I guess I'll call it, in the insurance industry the last 22 years, rates consistently go up and down. Sometimes they overestimate how much they need, and so then they end up, which was the company I worked for in the last 2 years, filed rate decreases. And so it happens all the time because they're trying to gauge rates with losses and catastrophes, and so they're constantly changing up and down. But I see other companies coming into the market, and they typically like to file a better rate because they see an opportunity to write business cheaper. And so it is a competition thing as well. But I see what you're saying as far as prices going up. It impacts that as well. But Commerce Department, why don't you state your name and answer her question, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patrick Nelson. I'm a deputy commissioner at the Commerce Department. It's my feast day, so go easy on me. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Go ahead, Representative Goodwin.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question was, how does the expedited form and rate filing and this and Representative Wilkins' bill differ from what we currently do for rate filings? Can you kind of give me, it would be really helpful to see a list. And this is important because I know no matter what the insurance industry says, it is not a difficult process in Minnesota to change rates. There are states that are much tougher than Minnesota to change rates, and sometimes I wonder if some of those rates are passed on to us. And some of them have caps on rate increases as well. Some states do. So, and we don't. So I'm just wondering if how this will change the way you do business currently, this language.
Go ahead.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin. Yes, it first of all, we read it as applying to two things, automobile and homeowners, which are property and casualty products that have some long history. So there, it's not a newer type policy. And what the principal difference, as I read it, is that they would tell us they're coming to market with a new form, and they would keep the policy itself at their place of business, and hopefully as part of this online. What we do now is we get the form, the actual paper form, in some instances. In some instances, the NAIC is using a process called SERF, which is an electronic filing of the form. So we don't actually take the paper anymore when the companies use the SERF filing. So the principal difference between Section 3 and what we do now is we won't be taking in the paper, and we won't be reviewing all the policy language. We would have the ability to do audits. They're going to be certifying that they comply with Minnesota law, which is the standard now. The standard upon which we review policies now is basically the standard that they'd be certifying here. So the principal difference is the recognizing that the world has changed a little bit. The NAIC, which is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, is sponsoring a lot of speed to market initiatives because there's a feeling in amongst the state regulators that there's a movement afoot to federalize a lot of this insurance regulation, and product filings being one of them. And so there's some thought that if you go to the certification-based filing, that will retain state jurisdiction for review of products and have the ability to regulate these instead of having the Fed centralize the policy form filings.
One more. We've got about six more people.
I don't want to monopolize here, but I just do want to ask, how long does it take now for when new rates are filed for them to get approved by the department, and how long would it take with this change?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, right now, there's a 60-day deemer provision in law relating to these products. So in effect, unless the deemer is waived, they take about 60 days. Our average, I guess, is right around there anyway right now. So some of them actually do take longer than that, particularly when it's an ISO filing, which is a service organization that files on behalf of a number of companies. Some of those filings get quite complex, and then we do ask for the waiver of the deemer provision, and so the time on a filing like that might be 90 days or something like that, and it can get significantly longer, although we've made significant improvements in that. But one of the reasons I think that the people are bringing forth this bill is that there is some concern that we took too long on some types of filings.
Representative Wilkin, you had a comment?
No, I lost my phone.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, the 60-day deemer part, I think, can be a little deceptive because companies are filing, especially larger ones, are filing a lot of different rates and forms. And the people who are working on approving these, if you go and you take it as deemed, you risk alienating the staff that is going to be working on your next product. And so companies don't like getting in an adversarial relationship with the regulators. They want to have a cooperative relationship, but sometimes things aren't moving along. But the companies are very apprehensive about going the deemed route.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my questions have been answered here in the discussion.
Representative House.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin, or maybe Mr. Spizzetto. The part that I'm maybe just a little confused with and unsure is Section 7, Subdivision 7. You're talking about the memorandum or the memorandum of coverage or the binder.
Yeah.
And Mr. Spizzetto, you used an example of being at a mortgage closing and you needed to have the binder. It could be electronically transferred. Can't you already do that without this? If you were at a mortgage closing and it wasn't there, wouldn't that be acceptable by the closing company or in a court as factual information? And then I guess what I'm nervous about after that question is, again, in my district, we don't have a lot of fax machines and computers at home. But my bigger concern is if I buy my insurance and I would then have to fill out a form and give them my email address. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do it. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Houses, I understand this. You can get a written binder if you want. There's no problem providing that. This would just allow us in situations where you needed it quickly to do it through email or fax, whatever's the quickest way to deliver it to you, and that would have the validity of the law by putting it in this section to be a legal binder. So if it ever got into a question of whether this is really a binder or not, by putting this in statute, you'd have the protection to say, yes, this is an electronic legal binder for this purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I'm still a little nervous about the electronic part, the emailing and
Mr. Johnson.
Can I jump in? And actually, if you look on page 6 and then look at the lines, if you don't have a fax or any electronic, this paragraph requires that it be mailed. So in other words, if there's nothing electronic that it can move on, it has to be mailed. So we don't actually eliminate the mailing paper requirement. That stays. You can satisfy it. It being a requirement of this law, if you want to do it by a fax or electronic, but if you don't have that, it has to be mailed, so that doesn't get eliminated, which is the current law. The only way to satisfy this written binder is that it has to be mailed. So we keep the mailing requirement unless it's done electronically. So that's how it would be worded, and in all those areas that would just continue. If there's no ability to move it electronically, it has to be moved in paper form by the U.S. mail.
And I'll say, Mr. Spizzetto is right, the homeowner claim or the homeowner binder is the perfect example of where this really speeds up the process. You come to a closing, And technically, they're supposed to have that written binder. And now this is saying, look, you can fax it, which often happens anyway. You know, so it's good. Representative House.
Chairman, just a follow-up. I can't remember your name on the end there. Sorry. I don't agree with how you say it must. I don't see here where it says it must be mailed. Okay. The last sentence is a memorandum of coverage or binder must be provided by the insurer to the policyholder upon request.
Back up. Start on line 6.
All the way up to line 6, yes.
Yep. Shall execute and forward a memorandum or binder containing the terms within 5 business days. Shall execute and forward. That means it has to be sent.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, but it doesn't say by mail. House.
Well, okay. Well, this has always been sent.
I
don't know any other way to send it. If we want to put by mail, we could put by mail, but that's how it's sent.
I think we can fix it, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative House.
Representative Wilkin.
If one of your constituents doesn't have or is unwilling to provide an email address for a fax, the insurance company is still under the obligation to get that binder, and the only other way to do it is by mail.
Right.
So if they just say, no, I don't want, they're protective of their email address, and most people don't have a fax at home, they're covered. They just, no, I don't have it. Send it by mail.
Mr. Nelson, would you agree with that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We would read that they would have to deliver it. And if that was the only means available, that's how they would have to do it. We would enforce it to be getting it to them somehow, and if they don't have email or a fax machine, that's what's left.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'll work with Representative Wilkin because I think I have an idea that would satisfy me and a lot of other people just by adding a few words at the end of this section. And it wouldn't hurt what you're trying to accomplish. So I'll work with the...
Okay, Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I agree with Representative Howes that it isn't clear on this, and it definitely needs correction language before going very far. It also, even under this, you could say you wouldn't give them the email, but if you've already given that and they send it over a computer and you don't have a printer at home, there's no way you have a record that you could keep since you couldn't print out what you got on the computer. So they would be complying with this, and yet the homeowner would have no way to comply. And the fact is, I think somebody already mentioned it. I know from having represented the largest title company in the country for years, most closers accept these already. But I have a question for Mr. Johnson on his statements about taking too long. I've talked to people in the industry and also some at the that used to be employed at the agency, and would you disagree with what they tell me that it's not the incompetence or anything of the people over there, it's the fact that there's a combination of more filings plus cutting funds for the department or the division that has really contributed to the backlog and the delay?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulry, I don't know if you were here when we started. I have never stated it's got anything to do with competency. That's not the issue. And my first comments were quoting out of the resource source book of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners that our Minnesota department, out of all 50 states, has had the greatest percent cutback in FTEs nationwide in the last 5 years, and so I identified up front there's a resource issue, but frankly the other reality is that the movement towards, as Deputy Commissioner Nelson indicated, and I think the NEIC as the regulators are acknowledging the need for and the benefits of enhancing the speed to market issue, particularly in areas like auto, personal auto, and homeowners, where there is much more, let's just say, uniformity in the products involved. We're not proposing that in the areas of annuities, a very complex financial services product with they're tailored, they're different. In fact, in that area, we're suggesting we want to bring more resources to the table to help the department expedite the process by paying for outside actuaries that they can pick. So this bill is a combination of additional resources, speed ups in particular areas where we think it's warranted. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, you can ask the department people through the years. I have always committed to the commissioners of whatever stripe to come up here and work for and lobby for if it would be helpful. Additional resources for this department to have the people to fully and completely do the job of review. We're not afraid of that at all. But the reality is that's not what's been happening. So we need to just need to get at this in a smarter way. We think this is a smart way.
Representative Yaros.
Mr. Chairman, last month I found out something new. I didn't know that insurance rates policyholders are also determined on the basis of credit rating. A retired teacher who never had any credit problems said that his rates went up on his auto and home. And he found out that the reason that his rates went up was because he didn't accept those credit card offers that that we all get through mail. I say, is that possible? Maybe we could take care of that in this bill. This bill looks like it's broken, and we wouldn't have to hear. I believe I introduced a bill dealing with this issue. Then we wouldn't have to have another hearing if you just put in a sentence in this bill to take care of that. It's unfair, I think. If a person doesn't have auto or accidents or fires or whatever claims against the home policy, why should they be punished because of credit? I don't think it has much to do with insurance.
Mr. Spicetto, are you going to answer that one?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'll give it a shot. Mr. Chairman, Representative Yaros, we did pass a law about 3 years ago, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, that specifically said that the lack of credit, the fact that you didn't have a credit score, you didn't have a credit history, could not be used against you in the credit scoring formula that companies use now. And Representative Davids, who you may recall was very interested in that particular issue, was the author of that legislation. So I think what happened in that situation is that I don't think it's the lack of credit that affects that. Now, there may be something else in the credit history that we're not privy to that may affect that score. And I will tell you, yes, most insurance companies are using credit scores now as a major part of their underwriting. And several years ago, the agents groups brought forth legislation to attempt to eliminate that. But over the years, we've become more comfortable with that. And I think now you've seen, in fact, beginning this month, Minnesota consumers now will have the opportunity to get a free copy of their own credit information. And credit scores are being used on a variety of things, not just insurance, obviously for financial institutions, mortgages. And the reason that you're getting those things in the mail is probably because you have a decent credit score, because they're not going to be sending out all of those applications to people who they don't think are going to be creditworthy. So I think we've addressed your specific concern in statute. So if that person has a problem, I think you could refer them to the Commerce Department to see if that's being done.
Oh, okay.
In addition, I don't know that we'd have peace in the valley on that one with this bill.
Mr. Chairman, just
Reverend Garros,
if they should be used, the credit rating of somebody that it should be used, you know, just because they may not be able to pay their bills doesn't mean that they're bad drivers or their homes are burning up.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yaros, I agree with you that it seems somewhat counterintuitive, but the industry has been able to convince the commissioners and regulators throughout the country that there is a valid correlation between these credit scores and how they're determined and the number of claim submissions under auto and homeowners insurance. And other than that, there's really no valid argument.
To that point, Mr. Chairman.
No, Representative Loeffler. You got about five. Yeah, I got you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Wilkins. Is this bill going to the Civil Law Committee? I know at one time we had a policy of anything that dealt with data privacy going so that we would have kind of a standard approach to all this. And is that a stop that this bill will be stepping in?
Representative Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, yeah, the motion is to go directly to Civil Law from this committee.
Thank you, because then I won't raise some of the, I had some of the same concerns that Representative Goodwin had about the long-term data privacy that I'm thinking about, and it relates somewhat to the work of our committee in the bioscience division, where we've been learning about how we've got this new science that says, you know, you can do a genetic DNA, genetic blueprint, and it can figure out which drug works for you or doesn't work for you on particular medical instances, and so it's not trial and error, which is really exciting. But, you know, a person may not want that same genetic blueprint that was used to write a prescription, used to evaluate whether or not to issue them long-term care insurance. And they're having signed an authorization 10 or 15 years ago before any of this new science came forward seems to be an issue. And, I mean, even with my bank, I have to once a year get a disclosure of what information they collect, how they use it. And so I'm glad that'll be addressed in another committee. I am concerned, though, about the impact of us, speeding up the ability of the industry to offer more and more products, and whether that in the long term serves the consumer interest in terms of manageable costs for insurance. And I mean, if you bring up the word insurance to a normal group of the public, their first thing is to talk about health insurance and how that's, you know, out of control, and a lot of us have spent a lot of time, a lot of other people in this body, trying to bring that under control, and 18 to 30% of the cost of it is just the processing of paperwork. And when I hear that there are 6,000 products, new products filed every year for the Department of Commerce to review, I don't need 1,000 options when I'm buying auto or health insurance or property insurance. I'm wondering if we're actually speeding up the system so now we can have 10,000 different separate products, and if that doesn't ultimately contribute significantly to the rate increases that we see in our policies. And I'm certainly someone who's still learning about this aspect of business, but it seems to me that I don't know that we should be encouraging rapid escalation in the number of products, even if that's where the market's going. I don't know if it's in the as a society's best interest. And it's maybe if someone from the industry or Representative Wilkins could address what's driving 6,000 new offerings a year. I mean, that's just an astounding number to me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I should just give some comments on it. And the 6,000 filings, that includes a lot of the current companies and the products they're selling annually, auto, homeowners. So that's not new products, new companies. That's who's out there right now. And so they're filing their products on an annual basis. So landscape-wise, what to respond to your question, if we showed you the charts of which companies are selling in which product lines and what are their market shares, we could show you the information, the number of licensed companies. And frankly, what you may find interesting is that even in the Midwest, the number of companies doing business varies quite considerably between Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, the Dakotas. You may not think, I mean, I wouldn't think that to be the case. And here's the comment I'll give, and you probably wouldn't be surprised at this, that more competition is a better result for buyers. It doesn't cause rates to go up. You get more companies competing for the business. The winner in that is consumers who get more options. And frankly, there are studies out in this country, I don't have them here, but I could get them to you from other states, that conclude that a positive factor for consumers in their states is having more companies involved with selling auto and homeowners. Because frankly, if more companies are there, the only way they get business is to compete with the other companies. And so Wisconsin, for instance, has got over 275 more companies selling product in their state than we do in Minnesota, which is just an interesting number. I mean, and I don't have all of the reasons, but I can assure you, one of the reasons that Wisconsin is a state and an agency and a department there that has been a quick speed to market company. They have, or state, excuse me, in the regulatory climate. So I think if you believe that a greater number of companies, I've been in enough hearings up here in recent days and weeks where the debate at the tables here are about the lack of any company selling insurance. And I can think of four hearings that come to mind right instantly in the last 3 weeks in this building, where the buyers coming to this table is coming to the legislature saying, please help us figure out a way to get more sellers of insurance products. So the point of the matter is that there are a number of places where the marketplaces are squeezing down, or they've squeezed out, and the buyers, consumers, don't have any options, and they're asking for help. So I think, frankly, helping the landscape in terms of companies selling, that if you believe in private competitive markets, I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that healthy private competitive markets are a good result for buyers. They get more choices. They get more choices. There's a good chance they're going to get something cheaper.
Members, we have about four more representatives that want to ask questions. I want to get to Sertich's bill. So, Representative Liebling, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've been holding on to my question for a while, so it kind of relates back to some issues that were discussed before under this thing about expedited form and rate filing. And I'll skip some of what I wanted to ask just to save time. But I wanted to ask Assistant Commissioner Nelson about this. You talked about a deemer, and I assume that you meant by that you didn't define it, and I'm kind of new to this, but I guess you mean that after a certain point things are deemed approved. That's how I understood that. But the question is, you know, how long, going to Mr. Johnson's response to you, that he said that we don't like to assume that those are, I guess they're giving the department more time, and I just wanted to ask you, how much time is it really taking then? You know, is it taking substantially more than that time than the deemer time?
Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as I said, over the last year or so, we brought down our average time to around 60 days, partially with the use of the deemer provision. And you are correct. The deemer means that if 60 days have passed and we haven't acted, the form is deemed approved. Historically, and as a point of practice, if we are going to take a look at a filing and we are approaching the 60 days, we ask the company for an extension of time so that it isn't automatically deemed. And historically, that's been granted. And I don't know if I want to say it's because they're afraid of their next result or not, but historically, it has been granted by the companies. So, depending on the complexity of the filing, the newness of the filing, I think that goes to the prior question, many of those 6,000 filings are things that are amendments to current products. So it's not all new products, and it's rates and forms and rules, and there's a whole big mix. And so there is sort of a matrix of how complicated it is, how new it is the first impression for us. All those go into how long it might take us to review a filing. So I really can only speak to averages, and we may get a simple name change or something out in a couple of days. Well, I don't know if that, but shortly, and it may take up to a year on some of these ISO filings, which is part of the genesis of this bill. I'm presuming is that the world is just more impatient than it used to be. There's a lot of this work. We do our best to try and accommodate the need for the business of insurance to have some certainty and some speed, and we do make some use of the deemer, but it varies all over the lot as to how long it might take us to do a particular filing.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And this is actually the second part of my question. Thank you for that answer. Going to this written certification that this bill, you know, somebody said, I don't know if it was Mr. Johnson, said, Representative Wilson said, well, you know, we trust these officers, you know, they're going to do the right thing. And, of course, that made me think of Enron immediately, although, of course, it is insurance. But, you know, how far do we trust? I think the public is not in a real trusting mood when it comes to CEOs of corporations. And I'm just wondering, what is this written certification? Is it under penalty of perjury, or is there some penalty attached to a false certification?
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have been working with the author and the industry to on that issue, and I think we're going to have a proposal to beef up the audit ability under this certification. I think we would say right now, if nothing changed, we would have the ability to audit, because we can always do market conducts, and this is actually, in some respects, a better tool for managing corporate malfeasance than probably what we have now. Although they, in theory, should be following the law, it isn't quite so black and white without this certification. I think with this certification, we will have the opportunity to say, if we do a market conduct and there is a corporate practice to flaunt Minnesota law, I think that this will give us an additional tool to post form under work on that. So yes,
Representative Clark.
Should be real brief, but I when we started talking about credit scoring, I mean that was a very controversial issue, and the former chair who usually sits in this seat here today, Representative Davis, I think the bill he brought forward was not very popular with the industry, if I recall, got watered down quite a bit. But credit scoring is a real issue, and I guess Representative Giles left, but I hope the department takes his and the insurance industry takes his concern seriously. Just in regard to that, I mean, Mr. Esposito, the comment you made about credit card companies only sending credit cards to good risk is just way out of touch with what's happening. Former Representative Rhodes was, very involved in helping people try to deal with their credit problems and, avoid bankruptcy and all the kinds of issues that happens when people get behind in their bills. And I know other public discussions too, but I can remember several discussions with him about the fact that it's just amazing that as soon as a person has a financial problem, as soon as they appear on any sort of credit risk and their credit score goes down, they begin to get lots more credit card applications. There are agencies whose whole purpose is to really, try to offer a quick fix. You can borrow X amount of dollars from us and take care of all your problems, and they're just very bad actors in terms of what that does to those individuals' ability to solve their problems. So I just want to mention that, because if you're not aware of that, it's a very big movement right now.
Thank you. Representative Goodwin.
I do have a final question. On page 10, this language about credit scoring, it looks to me like that gives them, the insurance industry, more power to use that. Am I correct or not?
Mr. Johnson.
And I laugh, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, no, it doesn't get more power, and as I was going to comment on Representative Clark's comment, I don't remember the citation, maybe Mr. Pender might, but the law that Chairman Davids, and he did push, and we had some interesting, we had a tough debate, and the law that was passed by Chairman Davids, which still stands as not being touched, specifically and continues to regulate the use of credit scores. So in other words, and that, I don't have the citation here, I'm sorry, so I can't read it to you, but this doesn't change that. This simply goes to the access and it, not once it's obtained, how we can utilize it. So Dominic Spizzetto's comments about you can't, if somebody has no credit history, you can't use that. That's still in the law. The law that was passed says that credit score can't be the only factor. In other words, it specifically says that when a company, some of you may remember this, that the law that Chairman Davids passed mandates that other factors, whether it's auto, homeowners, driving, the other kinds of things that we'd expect to use, have to be used as part of the decision-making process. So that statute is not being changed at all by this language. But that's responsive. In other words, it doesn't change the core Minnesota statutes that regulate that, the use of that factor.
Mr. Chairman, briefly, just point out, Representative Davids is on this bill. So, he's always concerned about this issue, but he is on the bill in support of it.
I'm sorry, Representative Wilkin, I
took care of it here. Thank you.
Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Mr. Johnson, when I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I put my tie on, I ask myself, so what could I argue with Bob Johnson about today? And I looked at this bill, and I have minor reservations that have been raised, and I think raised well, and would hope that some will continue to be addressed as the bill moves. There are a number of really good things in this bill. So it just goes to show that even a blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while.
Is that a thank you that I owe you now?
Have you ever been so well complimented, Mr. Jess? There's three things that I'd call people's attention to. One is file and use, which has been talked about.
used in 30 other states. These are great jobs that we can compete for, that we have competed for in the past, and file and use is a big part of how we can compete for those jobs. Just as important, though, is that consumers still maintain every protection under the law that they currently have. Finally, I do believe that the file and use leads to better and more responsive rates. Maybe more rates, but certainly more responsive and more competitive rates. Secondly, in Section 4 of the bill, current law, and a lot of folks don't know this, current law requires rehabilitation of really bad agents. This effort at rehabbing some terrible, terrible people or people that engage in terrible practices, this does away with that rehab requirement. These folks should not be in the insurance industry. It's a poor reflection on Mr. Johnson and Mr. Sposito's clients. And I think the sooner we get them out, the better. So that's another good component. The final one is just a very simple one, and that is the allowance for electronic binders. In this day and age, you go to a mortgage closing, you're trying to get your act in order. You should be able, there's no reason, put it this way, there's no reason that you should not be able to get an electronic binder, either via fax or via email. So there are a lot of good components. I expect that there will continue to be more efforts to work on the little things that we've got reservations about. It's a good bill for consumers, and it's a good bill for the industry, and I think it makes us more competitive as a state, getting some or keeping some darn good jobs around. So thank you for bringing it. You know what?
I liked what he said.
I've never been able to say that to Mr. Johnson before. It's so nice. No, but it's very good, Bill. I have to clean my nose up. No.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering what the Representative Atkins Committee's name is.
Representative Wilkins, do you have other testifiers that you...
If Mr. Marsh would like to come down, I think he'd have a couple brief comments and support.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marcus Marsh with the Farm Mutuals. I just wanted to go on record. I'm here to testify in favor of Section 3. I'll be very, very brief. I think the issues have been very well covered. But I do want to also point out for companies like ours, we are kind of in a unique situation. We have the Farm Mutuals that we use the standard policy that's filed by one of our statewide members because we don't write liability. We also have captive Minnesota statewide mutual members that are in competition against other states, and then our multi-state mutuals. And the file and use provisions Section 3, we think, are very important for competition reasons, for streamlining. And I know from our member companies, nobody's going to certify anything unless it's absolutely true because we're here every day and we're just trying to do the best job we can. Deputy Commissioner Pat Nelson made reference to something I wanted to touch on real briefly because it is significant. We go to Washington every year with our association to talk about things on a federal level. And members of Congress, as well as the NAIC, are talking a lot about federal regulation. And without modernization, there's going to be a bigger hammer from the federal government, potentially, to do federal regulation of some aspects, if not all, of the insurance industry down the road. And I, quite frankly, I'd ask you on the committee if you want to see federal regulation of the insurance industry. And I think the answer is unequivocally no. It would not. You have a response right to the department this way. You get answers. You get things resolved. If you're dealing with the federal government, I don't think you're going to have things resolved. And that is just a sidelight, but nonetheless an important aspect of what's happening nationwide. And I think why the NAIC and our national association and other groups are concerned about making sure modernization is part of what we do here in Minnesota. So I just wanted to make sure that we're on record with our association of being in support of the bill, in particular Section 3.
Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Mr. Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, I think we beat this one to death pretty good in our debate, and I don't have anything further to add.
Would you like to renew your motion?
Absolutely. Renew the motion to recommend that House File 1669 be recommended pass and re-referred to the committee as amended to the committee.
Civil law, right?
Yep, that's the one.
All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you very much, members.
Representative Sertich, to your bill. Representative Sertich, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would move that House File 792 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register, please.
No. Proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd first like to take care of an amendment and move the H0792A1 amendment, please.
Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Basically, what that amendment does is deletes the first few lines on the bill and will make this bill very non-controversial.
That's what they all say. Any more discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Passes.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a Department of Commerce bill that was brought to me. What you really should know about it is the bill is authored by myself and Representative Wilkin, and I shouldn't probably need to say much more, but I will go beyond that a bit. This bill does a few technical things. In the two remaining sections, what it does is it exempts residential mortgage originators and services and athletic agents on a list of exemptions that include anywhere from plumbers to podiatrists, aircrafts to watercrafts. There are many reasons for exemptions, and Mr. Levasseur will go into that. Number three, goes to the Department of Commerce, administers the Contractors Recovery Fund, and what this does is includes that that the costs to the department will be repaid through the fund and the fee that is set in place for that. And if you need any more information on this, I have my expert witness sitting right next to me.
Representative Goodwin.
Surprise. Mr. Chair, I do have a few questions. I'm not opposed to this. I just want you to know that that I have some concerns about the Contractor Recovery Fund and in some ways we can help make that a better thing and more helpful to homeowners. First question is, do you plan on hiring more staff? Right now your department is very low on the number of inspectors you have going out, code inspectors and so forth. Are code inspectors going to be paid out of this fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gooden, no. All this language does is allow the department to recapture its cost in administering this program. We have an employee who administers this program along with the Real Estate Recovery Fund, which is very similar. The Real Estate Fund has had language in the statute since I think 78, allowing the commissioner to recapture the cost of administration. When this fund was established in 94, I think it was, that comparable language wasn't inserted. So what happens when we get a claim, maybe to give you a little background, a claim comes in against this fund. An individual has to obtain a judgment against a contractor, and the department reviews the judgment, determines whether or not coverage is available. It also determines whether or not the claim is representative of the actual out-of-pocket expense, because that's all the statute will allow coverage for. And that's where we use our own staff. We'll send them out, folks from our building contractor section, to examine the construction or the defect or whatever it might be that was the source of the claim. So right now we are working with the Department of Administration to effect a mobility transfer with them to bring one of their people over to Commerce to supplement this program. But they will continue to pay the salary on that individual. So it will not impact our costs.
Okay.
This is a good one.
Yeah, I just have a few more questions, because I think we do need to do some other things with this Contractor Recovery Fund that aren't in this bill, and maybe we can't do them today, but I do want to mention them to you and hope we can work on something here. One thing that homeowners complain about is the fact that they have to get a court judgment before having access to this fund. In other words, a mediation or an arbitration is not enough to get them help when the contractor has gone out of business or has done damage that they can't pay for or doesn't have insurance or whatever the issues may be. So I think that's an important way to slow down litigation would be to allow homeowners to have access to it once they've been through arbitration or once they've been through a mediation and it's been settled, but there's no money for them to get paid for their repairs. Another thing is I think that your department needs, or the Department of Administration or both of you need more enforcement ability on builders and contractors. I think the license should also be issued to the contractor, not to the contractor's company, because these contractors are going out of business, changing their name, then the homeowner has no access to the warranty provisions anymore because, or to the contractor because they're out of business. So that's another thing. And I'll talk to you about these things later, but I just kind of wanted to say it here because I think everybody needs to hear. Also that the Contractor Recovery Fund lost over $2 million last year when the governor transferred that into the general fund. And I want to know if you feel you have enough money in there now to cover the kinds of things, the kinds of claims that you have from homeowners right now. Do you have enough money in there now? Do you expect to have enough money in there to cover the claims that come into you in the next biennium, for example?
Mr. Levasseur.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, to the best of my belief, there's sufficient funds in the account to cover claims, and there will be sufficient funds during the next biennium. What we're experiencing right now is there's a balance of a little more than $1 million in the fund, a carry-forward balance. Now, each year upon renewal, the fund picks up another approximate $1.4 million. The claims over the last couple of years have been averaging about $1.2 to $1.4 million. So the $1 million balance has just kind of been carrying forward from year to year. Now, if claims, if we run into a situation where there is not sufficient funds in this account to cover consumer claims, then the commissioner has the authority to make a special assessment on the licensees in this industry. And we have the same authority in the real estate industry, and we've exercised that authority from time to time over the last 25 years. Not very often, but when it's necessary, we've done it. So I do think it's, at this point anyway, it's adequately funded. We've tried to keep the cost to a minimum in order not to establish any kind of barrier for people who want to get into the business, but yet exercise some financial responsibility so far as making sure we have a solvent fund.
Mr. Chu, just one follow-up.
Representative Goodwin.
Quick. I want to know how much of the fund money is going to be taken out for administrative use in this next biennium if this bill passes, and how many homeowners you expect to be dealing with or you routinely are get use of this fund in a biennium.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I don't have the number of homeowners. I could sure look that information up for you and be happy to provide it to you. The funds, we anticipate the administrative costs to be less than $100,000, but the administrative costs will cover legal costs, claim investigation costs, litigation costs, and just general administration costs. So we think the fund is extremely well run, like I say, it's just right now the state is subsidizing the operation of this fund. Comparable funds we don't subsidize, and so we're proposing that the fund pay for its own operation.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to know that there is one person here that would like to testify about this fund. So. Okay.
Come on down. State your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Emerson, and I actually was before this committee on the right to repair bill on Tuesday, and you might not understand why I'm here now. And one of the reasons I'm here, I can't see, one of the reasons I'm here is because when I returned from California in 1998, I had a career in as a project manager, systems business analyst, and I cut my teeth on that kind of process because I worked for the legislature when I was in college as an undergraduate research assistant. So when my problems came up, I decided to start researching what was going on, and the contractor recovery plan fund is part of this whole homeowner problem and hopefully resolution. I've spent a year and a half going to U of M courses, sitting in and building admin meetings, and what I've found in this whole thing is that the builders, the insurance companies, the Department of Admin, the Department of Commerce, they're all staking their heads in the sand and saying they're not going to go any further. And who ends up being stuck in the middle with all these different problems is the homeowner. I routinely look on the website for the Department of Commerce to see what the contractor funds.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin.
Could I ask the witness what this has to do directly with this bill?
I'm talking about the contract fund right now.
Yes, but does that deal with the change that is made in this
yes,
bill?
Yes, because I think that if the... Okay. If one is going to change the contractor's recovery fund to allow the Department of Commerce to get regain their expenses for administering this fund, then I think that... as Representative Goodwin said a couple of things, that the fund should be made more available to homeowners. Right now it's not. And I don't think until that time that we should allow them to reimburse their expenses. I've pulled out this 16-page app to this fund right now, and there's no guarantee. Generally, you can apply to the fund to recover the amount of actual and direct out-of-pocket loss you suffered in the transaction with your contractor. Attorney fees and stuff aren't part of it. Applicants may be paid any amount from $0 to $50,000. You may be entitled to compensation, but there's no criteria or anything else. And I think until those things are resolved, that I, given the amount of money that I have just heard that is in the fund, it should be more accessible to homeowners. And I think one of the incentives is to get this fund up to date and correct and get and start to solve the whole problem would be to not, I don't think we should give funds to a department to administer it when we're not giving it to the homeowners. The criteria is unclear, and I don't think that's fair to the people that need this fund. And so I would like to not, and maybe what I see this as, not giving them the funds for their costs, is an incentive for them to get their ducks in an order so that the next time they want those funds, we can say, fine, you've earned them.
Mr. Chairman, welcome.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if we could have Mr. Levasseur come back. Mr. Levasseur, I'm just kind of catching up here on this, but that seems to me like a totally different subject, and maybe a subject for another bill or something, but it has really nothing to do with this provision. Maybe you can, do you see a connection here, other than we're talking about the same fund, but what the department's asking us to do in the connection to more accessibility to homeowners do seem like two different subjects.
Mr. Levasseur.
Mr. Chair, in my opinion, they are two distinctly different subjects. There has been a significant amount of discussion over the years here in the legislature about whether the levels of recovery are sufficient. Should homeowners be able to recover more money? We have an expedited process for claims that are $7,500 or less that homeowners can apply to. But there is a balancing act that you always have to take into consideration in these cases, and that's the rights of the contractor to due process. And contractors have a right to contest claims that are made against the fund because they're going to lose their license. They're not only going to lose their license, but they're not going to be able to get a license back unless they repay the fund at least twice what the fund has paid out on the consumer's behalf. So there are a lot of areas where there's a lot of controversy about the fund itself. I don't see how that has any direct impact on the department recapturing its cost to administer the fund.
Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Representative Surtich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilkin, Representative Goodwin, and Ms. Marsh. Thank you, and you know I share your concern and have over the last few years about doing better in this area. Though I do disagree just a bit with you about this, only because the folks that are going to administer this fund to help out homeowners are the ones I think that we're going to be, if we don't pass this bill, they're not going to have the tools to administer the fund as it stands right now. So I think we do need to move forward on both tracks to reconcile concerns that are shared, and hopefully Mr. Levasseur will work with Representative Goodwin to get her the information and get this process going. But I think to help those folks with the fund right now, I think that's the reason we need this bill passed. At a time when I'm sitting on the committees that is cutting the Department of Commerce, cutting those folks, we need at least for them to have an ability to help the individuals currently right now. But I do share your concerns.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Surtich. I noticed that you added athletes' agents, and since it, my impression of professional athletes is they don't like to talk in anything less than million-dollar terms, I just want to have your assurance that you think this fund is adequate to not be depleted by the new class that you're bringing in.
Representative Surtich, does this have anything to do with Kevin McHale being from Hibbing?
Mr. Chair, his cabin's in Representative Berkovina's district, and his house is in North Oaks, which is nowhere near the Iron Range anymore.
Representative Liebling. Or was your question answered, Representative Loeffler? Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I did hear one thing that I thought was a connection with what this other lady said and with this fund, and that is that I just wanted to clarify. When claims are made against this fund, do people get reimbursed for legal fees that they incur or not?
No, they're not. They're not entitled to legal fees. They're entitled to their actual out-of-pocket losses that they can demonstrate. And oftentimes, what happens is the claimant will get a default judgment because the contractor doesn't show up in court, and they'll be awarded an amount of money that won't necessarily will be more than their out-of-pocket losses. And so that's where the administration and the Attorney General's office and the department gets involved in discussions and sometimes even litigation with the claimant.
Representative Liebling?
Just to follow up on that, I do think that there is a little inequity there. If the homeowner can't recover their legal fee, but we're saying here that the department should be able to recover its legal fees out of the fund, I mean, I do think that's a little bit unfair. I mean, I appreciate the need to have this a change, but I guess that I don't know. I don't think that's really equitable. The department can get something out of it, and the claimant then can't get the same kind of reimbursement.
Representative Surtich.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think in this instance we have to look at the department as us as well. They might not have the resources to go to court on behalf of homeowners in the first place if we don't allow them the chance to recover some of their funds. They have no way of doing that legally right now, to my knowledge, to recover a portion, and that's all they will recover, and this is a portion. But it's really the folks that are administering the funds have the ability to recover. So it's, for lack of a better term, the good guys are recovering, you know, legal fees when they're helping out homeowners in recovery here. And I believe, and I'm nowhere near a lawyer, my sister is that homeowners through the court process can get their legal fees recovered through the court of law too. At least that's what she tells me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's important to realize that the recovery fund has never been the ultimate final solution for this problem. Many times homeowners have lost far more than $50,000 and have incurred costs that far exceed that. The recovery fund has just established some sort of mechanism where people can hopefully recover part of their costs. But, you know, prior to the recovery fund, the requirement was a $5,000 bond.
and that's all it took. And once $5,000 was used up, that was just too bad. So it's, you know, we're doing the best we can with the limited resources.
Well, seeing no more questions, Representative Search, you renew your motion that House File 792 as amended be passed and referred to the General Register.
I do, Mr. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
We are officially adjourned.